Support for this public radio podcast comes from AIG Travel Guard, providing travel insurance designed to help travelers face the unexpected. Learn more at travelguard.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of making art in the places where you'd think that would be the last thing on anyone's mind. Michael Fay is an artist, and he's a Marine. He's been twice to Afghanistan and twice to Iraq, also to Somalia, the Balkans, and Desert Storm. Michael tells a story about inheriting a set of dog tags. They originally belonged to a soldier who fought with the Royal Newfoundland Regiment at the Battle of Passchendaele in France. And on July 1st, 1917, 778 soldiers with the Royal Newfoundland went into battle. The next day, 68 of them reported for roll call. The man who carried Michael's tags was one of the 68 who survived. So whenever or wherever Michael Fay goes, he packs his rifle, along with a sketch pad and a camera. He is a Marine war artist. He also still carries the dog tags. I'll talk with him right after the news. A 145 years ago, a young artist by the name of Winslow Homer was living in Massachusetts and anxious to try his hand at illustrating the Civil War. So he armed himself with a letter from Fletcher Harper, the editor of what was then called Harper's Weekly. It identified Winslow as a special artist. And over a period of 4 years, he traveled back and forth to Virginia. And while his paintings from that time are well regarded, it's his wood engravings and his sketches in the magazine that helped define him as an artist who was helping define America at that time in history. Even today, there are military artists in the field with their own perspective on combat. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Michael Fay is a warrant officer with the Marines. He has served in a number of conflicts, and only just recently he took on the role of artist in the field. But Michael has always kept a diary. In Iraq, he kept an audio diary.
We've reached the final line of departure right across from the town of Ubaidi. Fox Company platoons are spreading out.
Michael Fay also carries a sketchbook and watercolors into battle. He is one of two combat artists with the Marines. In Iraq, he served in Al Anbar province. In recent months, Al Anbar has been marked as a place where American intervention has helped cool things down. But when Michael was there, it was one of the most dangerous parts of Iraq.
The slang term Marines used for Al Anbar was the Wild West. The further west you got, like Ramadi, Haditha, Husayba, all the way out on the Syrian border, Al Qaim, was still, it was the Wild West.
What do you remember seeing? I mean, you were there as an artist. What are the images that stick in your mind from that time in what was being called the Wild West?
The first thing that sticks in my mind is, you know, images of fellow Marines, because it's, you know, you wear a lot of gear and it's very hot and sweaty and there's not a lot of time to change your uniform. So guys look pretty crusty. So some of the first artwork I did, some sketches were a tribute to all the gear these guys had on and the conditions. And then also, you know, it was my fourth trip over, twice to Iraq, twice to Afghanistan. And, you know, the faces of the people are just, you know, wonderful, the Iraqi citizens and the women and kids and children. And, they're always coming up and out to you. And the villages were along the Euphrates River. So you sort of have the juxtaposition of sort of the expanse of desert against the very fertile farming area that borders the river, you know, date palm groves and orange groves, and certainly my first time I really ate, from the branch, fresh, delicious pomegranates, and then just the great expanse of sky and the often unexpected green. And if there were birds, I was trying to figure out what they were, and I found out they were called grebes.
Michael, if it was as wild at the time that you were there, how close could you get to the people? Were there times when you could get out of a Humvee, walk through a village, meet the women and the children and the men who were there?
Well, I think by and large, at least the Marines, I mean, you're not in the Humvees. You're out on foot patrols.
Okay.
Constantly interacting with them.
Do the people react differently to you because you're carrying a sketch pad instead of a rifle, or are you carrying both?
Well, I'm carrying both, and that's a question that always arises. You know, are you an artist first or a Marine first? It's kind of a balancing act. The sketching is sort of done after the patrols. I can't really ask them to stop and let me set up. but I do have my sketchbooks, and I know, like, the Iraqi soldiers always find it, what we call the jundi, you know, always find it fascinating, and they like to come over and watch you sketch, and the local people see how they react. And a lot of them can speak English, and you stop and you're talking, and they notice that you're noticing and observing perhaps a little more than the average jarhead, and you're taking pictures, and they sort of ask, oh, what do you do, sir? Mister, what are you doing? I say, I'm an artist. And they're like, an artist? No. And so you show what you do, and they're very thick, you know, Arabic accents going, you know, good, mister, very nice, good, you good. I think most of the GIs, and I'm sure the soldiers too, they come home, and or even while they're there, they have lots of memories of being engaged in a very positive way with the local population, you know, which of course is juxtaposed against, you know, 5 minutes later, some you know, firefight starts or an explosion goes off.
And, yeah, I wanted to ask you what happens when that happens. I mean, would someone turn to you and say, put your camera down, grab your rifle, we need you over here? Or do you do that instinctively? This is the balancing act you were talking about.
Right. I need to do that instinctively. You know, on one hand, I'm sort of like an embedded journalist. On the other hand, I'm also a Marine. So it's very important that whatever unit I'm with feels comfortable with me. You know, I'm on the patrol roster. The corporal's in charge is going to assign me a battle buddy, and it's like paired together. I have a place in what they call the line of march. So if you can imagine a dusty trail through a village, you know, a column of Marines on each side spaced out, you know, 15, 20 meters from each other. I'm, you know, walking X number of paces and turning around and looking to the rear. And if some shooting begins, you know, then it's, you know, my battle buddy, I got to watch out for him and vice versa.
Can you recall a specific incident during that most recent trip to Iraq when you were, in fact, being more of a soldier than you were an artist?
Oh, well, certainly I was in Operation Steel Curtain, which was a major combat operation that went from the Syrian border, started around in early November 2005. And, you know, that was pretty, rock 'em, sock 'em robots. That was pretty much combat from the kickoff to the end. So, you know, I snapped a lot of pictures, and I took digital audio recordings. Normally I keep a little journal, but I had a little digital recorder, so.
Time on deck is 8:15, and the firefight has been going on now for about 5 minutes.
Anybody okay up there?
I'm going to go ahead and just leave the recorder on.
Now, that's a little closer to the front line than I expected to find our Marine artist. I asked Michael Fay if he'd ever been wounded.
There would be secondary blasts, and I took a little bit of shrapnel in my left arm. Nothing, I didn't have to be medevac, but it was a reminder. And another time...
You're actually, right-handed, I assume. You have
I'm right-handed, yep. So
your right arm is your drawing arm.
And, you know, the corpsman, I believe it was quite minor, and the corpsman came over and tried sort of digging it out, and he said, well, you know, they're just going deeper. They'll fall out in the shower, which they did. you know, it's no different than what anybody else was going through. And probably the closest I ever came was actually at night in a Humvee going into an IED crater. The vehicle went in and out of the crater. And that was an interesting experience, not knowing, you know, what had happened if it had been an explosion or right. What. You know, it's war. It's inherently dangerous.
What you do is called combat art. But, mm-hmm. But I guess, Michael, a lot of it is not combat. I mean, you've described these moments when you're completely consumed with your job as a soldier, but my own experience in war zones, considerably more limited than yours, is that there's a whole lot of waiting around. There's a whole lot of boredom.
Well, you know, and I've done artwork where, I've, you know, it's basically titled Hurry Up and Wait. Any army in the world had some phrase that was equivalent to Hurry Up and Wait.
Right.
And, yeah, so, I mean, there is a good, you know, a portion of the artwork that I do that reflects that downtime, whether it's buddies, you know, shooting the breeze or sort of someone just sitting there with a blank look of ennui. It's all part and parcel to what we call combat art. I mean, in World War I, you know, certainly the British called it war artist. John Singer Sargent went as a war artist. But, you know, people during, you know, times of war, whether it's civilians or people in the military, it's been the subject of art, poetry, whatever, for a long time. I mean, certainly we wouldn't have, you know, the tale of brave Ulysses and all of that without Homer and without having something happened. So, and I'm sure, you know, the 10 years they were, sitting before Troy, those guys were pretty much bored out of their minds. And, you know, that's probably the subtext to the Trojan horse. It's like, you know, we got to come up with something because...
Let's build something. Let me ask you, though, Michael, how easy it is for you to, you know, switch from your soldier's eye to your artist's eye, whether you're taking a picture or, you know, thinking of the composition of a drawing that you might do I don't want to be too narrow-minded about this, but a lot of the time when I'm talking to artists, they're talking about the beauty in what they see, and yet you're in one of those sets of circumstances that may not present a whole lot of beauty.
Yeah, I mean, we could get into kind of a philosophical, what the word, beauty means. And certainly in a war zone, you're going to see things, forms, shapes, situations. And myself as a realist, especially with portraiture, I mean, you just see faces that are just remarkable and that just invite, being done. So, but to answer your original question about that juggling act between being a Marine and a combatant and being an artist, because they seem to be at odds with each other. One is, artist is inherently creative, and when you think of war or being a Marine, it's sort of inherently, destructive. One painting I did where I can really remember being out and being conscious of both aspects, it's called All Eyes Down, and it was sort of the first major work I did from my field experience. And it's a patrol of Marines outside of Kandahar International Airport, a patrol that I was on, and we were walking through the most heavily mined part of the planet. And it was at sunset. So, we just had this remarkable landscape, this beautiful peach melba, thick resinous light that's just sticking to everything and coming, low and slow across the landscape, and you got purple mountains in the distance. And you're kind of going into that time of the day, I call it the gloam, when things sort of start to glow from the inside and shadows start disappearing. And yet, here you're out and it's very, you can hear, gunfire in the distance, and you're with a patrol of Marines that's very gingerly picking its way across this beautiful landscape. And I can probably say I was probably the only one on the patrol that was having a poetic moment and looking at the beautiful Monet-like light. So it was very interesting for me to sort of be doing both things at once. So,
do you ever ask yourself, Michael, if you put yourself at greater risk? I mean, if a soldier uses all his or her senses to look for trouble and you allow your eye and your mind to wander the way that you just did, do you worry about that putting you at risk?
No, not really. I mean, I think there's a difference between being very acutely observant and falling into a reverie.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's a constant challenge in anybody that, that's going out to not be, distracted and not lose sense of where you're at. I'm sure every journalist, even civilian that's been out there taking pictures or something, there's moments they went, gosh, I was so, taken up with clicking pictures or writing down my impressions that I realized, I looked around and everybody was gone and it's me between the, the good guys and the bad guys, it's just that I happen to be, an armed combatant, and fellow Marines at some point, are looking to me to stop clicking pictures and start, clicking off rounds.
Watch their back.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Hey, those hay bales out there, staffs aren't right along the edge.
I mean, there's somebody in there.
You see somebody? No, they're all f***ed up, though. That's the perfect place to f***ing shoot if they're stopping right now.
To draw us across, and then I got a f***ing death wish. Well, I just fired my first full magazine. Holy f***.
The painting that Michael Fay was describing for me, that one he calls All Eyes Down, it's among the images that we have on our website at thestory.org. But as we'll hear from Michael in just a minute, his pictures aren't just art, they are connections to real people and some of the soldiers who don't make it. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Marine Warrant Officer Michael Fay has two jobs when he's in the field. He's a Marine artist, there to paint and sketch what he sees at the front line. But when he's on the front line, he's also a soldier and often called to assist with the fighting. Here's part of his own audio diary from Al Anbar province. A sergeant has just told the platoon that there may be two men, KIA, killed in action.
Watch your area. Sergeant B just said it could be possible two KIAs, his second platoon.
Compared to many young Marines today, Michael Fay, at the age of 54, is a veteran. He enlisted shortly after the Vietnam War. And that's a story we'll get to in a moment. But Michael makes the point that his years of service give him perspective. I asked about one drawing of his in particular. It's a portrait of a young Marine, Nick Chacon. Lance Corporal Chacon is clearly exhausted. He's looking down. Wrapped loosely around his neck is one of those large, sweat-stained scarves like the kafiyas soldiers adopted from their Arab counterparts.
I was in Afghanistan. It was January of 2002. And this is just when, you know, this whole global war on terrorism was starting. And the Marines had just projected from, I mean, virtually came ashore in Pakistan and went hundreds of miles, you know, a land march in amphibious assault vehicles up to Kandahar. I mean, the longest ship-to-shore assault in history. But we were, you know, we were out on the edge of the known universe, you know, and this particular patrol had originally, you know, gone out for only maybe 12-hour patrol and ended up being out there 9 days. And so when they were returning, I was in the Kandahar International Terminal, and there was a lot of buzz. I mean, there was AP and Reuters and a lot of, you know, CNN. Everybody was there. They knew that this patrol was coming back in, and, you know, there was the buzz about the look. They said, oh, gosh, these guys definitely probably going to have the look. So they were all very interested in getting images of them. And so when they came in, yeah, they definitely had been out there 9 days, and they, you know, the skin was windblown from the dust and the dirt, and they hadn't probably taken their clothes or their helmets off in, you know, almost 2 weeks. So they came in, and it was just fast and furious, and they came in, and, you know, I was just had my camera and was clicking away like everybody else. And afterwards, I got names of all these kids and reviewed the pictures, and that particular kid really just, like, popped out. It's like, oh, my gosh. And so I knew I wanted to do a, you know, a portrait of him.
Do you remember what it was about the photograph you'd taken that made you look twice?
It just struck me. It's just one of those images that you just go, wow, you know. And it certainly came to pass that this kid had, you know, had that look, and he had that weight of the world. And I was lucky enough to, you know, at least from an artistic standpoint, to be able to, you know, to capture that. And
yeah, he's so young, and he looks so weary in your drawing.
Right. It's the look. I mean, it's that young old look. You know, growing up, watching, you know, Walter Cronkite's The 20th Century, you know, on Friday nights, and looking at Life magazines and all the black and white photographs and books about World War II and World War I, you know, mostly it's these black and white images. And looking at these faces, you know, you really couldn't tell, you know, in hindsight how old they are. Now I'm looking at faces from World War II, and I realize these are people 30 years younger than me, yet there's something else going on there. And so, you know, with his face, you know, he just had it in spades. You know, in hindsight, it just was saying, you know, to draw him.
What happened to Nick?
From what I found out from his parents, unfortunately, Lance Corporal Chacon committed suicide. I had lost touch with him. I didn't know what happened, and I had put his picture up on my blog, and, you know, I had it captioned with his name. And his stepbrother, Matthew, one night had Googled his brother's name, and boom, up pops this image. And, you know, the whole family the next morning, he said, were just like, you know, was going from parent to parent, to cousin to friend. And it was right at Easter time, 2005, so it was, in a way, it had given them back to him, to them. And his mother was nice enough, and his stepdad, they came to the show at the Michener Museum up in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, and I invited them, and they came to the opening. You never know what art's going to do, so it was a very interesting experience.
Yeah, what was that like for you, to meet them, to know that you had given them that image of their son, which clearly is something that they now treasure?
You know, it's hard to put into words. It enters into the world, you know, the conflicted feelings, you know, to be able to capture the look of somebody, you know, who later on, unfortunately, took their own life. Yet to have the family be so moved by it, the picture had a life-giving aspect to it. And, I mean, it was very gratifying to me, you know, just as a person. Without any design, you know, you become part of these people's lives, and it you know, sort of leaves you speechless, I guess.
I wonder if, when you see the young men in uniform in circumstances like that, you see anything of yourself, because you're kind of in your second incarnation as a Marine. You were a young man in uniform.
Sure.
Back in the mid-70s, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
That was kind of a weird time to choose to join up. I mean, in the years after the Vietnam War, once the draft had ended, there weren't a lot of people who were choosing that as a career. How did you get there?
Well, you know, it was like an immature decision. That was the best immature decision I ever made. I was 21 when I joined the Marines. I had already, you know, been out of high school 4 years. I graduated from high school in 1971. And
short hair, long hair?
Oh, I had long hair. I would say I had 6 1/2 fist ponytail. And, you know, I had other friends that I went off to college with that were now graduating and, you know, going on to grad school or getting married. But here I was, you know, it was 1975, and they're all moving on, and I'm still living in my parents' basement. I have dropped out of another fine art school for the third time. And, you know, I was sort of like, well, what am I going to do here? And my dad had been in the Marines in World War II, and I had a cousin that was in the Marines in Vietnam. And among the youth of my day, you know, the Marines was sort of like the Foreign Legion. You know, it was sort of like the strangest thing you could do. I mean, just blew people's minds.
Almost exotic. See the world, right?
Yeah, it really was. And it was, and I did it somewhat, you know, I say immature. I did it somewhat for shock value. So I joined the Marines to be an infantryman, and I was an 81-millimeter mortarman.
Did you keep your sketchbook with you at the time, or had that had you put that aside at this
point?
No,
you know, to tell you the truth, I was, even in boot camp, officers and senior non-commissioned officers had a way of finding out a lot about you, and they knew that I had art talent. So they always, you know, kind of pulled me aside to do little projects.
So did you get to see the world? Did you get to places?
You know, I did not. Everybody around me had orders or saying to report to the 3rd Marine Division, Camp Smedley Butler, Okinawa. And I'm looking at my orders, and it says, report to Commanding Officer McAllister, OK. I called the staff sergeant over. I said, you know, everybody is going to 3rd Marine Division at Camp Butler, and I'm going to this MB McAllister on Okinawa. Where's that? And he goes, oh, no. He goes, you're not going to Okinawa. He goes, you're going to Oklahoma.
Though Michael's orders sent him to Oklahoma, he did see the world later in wartime. He says he turned to literature and religion to widen his perspective.
I said, well, maybe I should read the Bible. I won't say I've read the whole Bible. Some of those parts of the Bible that have the begat, 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 begat.
You skimmed that part.
Pretty much skimmed those parts. But a lot of these stories, you know, and like, you know, about Joseph and David, you know, I said, there must have been something happened that people felt compelled to write about it. And then I started thinking about Homer and this, you know, the Odyssey and the Iliad and the story of Troy and, you know, how these things, something very intense happened and people felt compelled to do the best they could to make sure that this story or whatever happened got told and retold and retold. And so my stepfather, Andy Franz, was a great guy. And after Andy died, we were taking care of his house. And there was this Harvard Classics, this collection of like 1908, the great classics. I mean, this wonderful leather-bound, never opened set of books.
Looked great on the bookshelf.
They were up on the bookshelf. They had, you know, they had 40, 50 years of dust on. And so I pretty much just pulled one down. It was, you know, Plutarch's Lives. And so I started reading, and it's a translation, and it was a little difficult to start reading. But the stories were so compelling, and in particular, the period of the Peloponnesian War.
Well, these are sketches. In a way, these are like literary portraits, right?
Absolutely.
Which is not that far from what you do.
Yeah, I think so. And they try to get some poetic content in there and some realism at the same time. You know, every Greek general or admiral that was successful seemed like he couldn't return to town. Success in the field didn't always translate into, you know, being able to come home. So they were sort of victims of their own success.
And their success was as military heroes, right? That's how they...
Right, in the field, yeah.
It sounds to me, though, that your study of these military people of 2,000 years ago, though, was drawn to the fact that, you know, what made them good in the field didn't necessarily make them good at home. Do you see anything in that in the soldiers that you know today, where they show their talent is not something that they ever get to bring back home?
I mean, you think there's always the intense kind of military experience to come back and reintegrate into society. I mean, Winslow Homer, the great, you know, combat artist or war artist of the Civil War, one of his great pieces is called A Veteran in a New Field. It's a Union veteran. His back is to you, and he has sort of the scythe, and he's bent over with the scythe, elbow deep in, you know, fresh wheat.
Yeah.
Yet you can see in the foreground is his tunic and his canteen from his, you know, life as a sort of a metaphor for his time as in the field. And certainly the scythe is a metaphor for death. And certainly Winslow Homer went and spent time in the field and observed these people. And although he was not a combatant, he certainly watched units form up and walk into cornfields and wheat fields, you know, to do combat.
Yeah.
So it was very interesting how he sort of anticipated, I think, this timeless thing of soldiers, people have been in the military, people going off to war, you know, reintegrating themselves. You know, we hear about PTSD. They used to call it, after the Civil War, soldier's heart. And I think it's something that, you know, we're going to hear more dialogue about. I hope in my art people can see that, you know, we're kind of looking into the face of the wounded and the deformed and the guys that are going through, you know, rehabilitation and whatnot.
Is that harder for you to do that kind of art now if you're doing a portrait of a wounded soldier? It doesn't necessarily have the flash or the light or the glamour or the heroism of work done in the field. And I'm not trying to say mm-hmm. they're totally unrelated, but there's quite a contrast there.
I mean, certainly I've been in combat where I've seen people, you know, killed and quite messed up. But a year ago, myself and my other artist, Sergeant Chris Battles, I proposed we'll do portraits of wounded warriors up in Bethesda and Walter Reed. So we arranged to go up there, and we went to both places. And I can tell you that I was, you know, had trepidation because obviously I didn't choose to go in the medical profession, probably because, you know, I didn't want to see, you know, blood and guts and gore, and people didn't look quite right. And so going up there, I was, you know, was concerned, like, well, how am I going to react to, you know, seeing somebody that's going, that's maybe lost an eye or limbs or going through facial reconstruction. And they put me at ease very quickly. They're just regular people. So, and the heroism is much subtler than probably, you know, Hollywood type heroism. But all of them that volunteered, and a lot of them volunteered to be drawn and photographed. Hopefully that came across their sort of unabashed, their courage. And I think that they knew they were still in the fight. You know, we have 90%, you know, survival rate now. So people that might have died before now are surviving. It's got to be more than survival. And these people are struggling with any number of physical and psychological issues. And it was quite gratifying to me and Sergeant Battles that these guys pretty much said, hey, here it is. Take a look at us. You know, we know we're not going to hide. And that's how we approached them, too. We said, you know, you're still in the fight. What you're doing is still part and parcel to what's going on. And I think they understood that. Individuals coming back are all going to, you know, provide sort of transformative energy to our culture. I mean, you got young women. I've been over there, and you got young women that have been in combat. I mean, my girlfriend was a sergeant first class in the Army Reserve, and she was over there for 14 months, got IED'd. Her translator was sitting behind her. She was driving, was killed. She and a lot of other women, veterans that have, you know, got Purple Hearts, have come back. You know, this is a transformative force.
Let me ask you how it has in any way transformed you, because you're in your mid-50s mm-hmm. now. You have been in, you know, different war situations now over a period of decades. Mm-hmm. You're kind of a grizzled old veteran over there, and you're looking at kids who are young enough to be your own children. Does that change your perspective?
No, not really. I mean, I will tell you, you know, it's one thing to go to the field and be with a 20, 21-year-old Marine corporal who is a seasoned veteran, putting your life completely in their hands. Because even though I'm a warrant officer, I'm going to tell that corporal, say, hey, partner, you're the man. You are the expert. You know, you tell me where you want me to be. And I'm 54. Isn't that still the early 50s? But, you know, it's very invigorating to be part and parcel to sort of the professionalism, the energy, and the dedication, and the sense of humor, and just the fullness of being with these, you know, young men and women who kind of transcend whatever our word is, young. I mean, they're neither young nor old.
Michael Fay is a Marine combat artist. You're listening to The Story from American Public Media. I'm Dick Gordon. I'm familiar with Canadian landscape painters who went to the First World War as artists. Their time on the battlefield changed them. When they returned, their landscapes became much more expressionistic, sometimes wild, almost chaotic. I asked Michael Fay if the time he spent trying to make sense of battle has changed him. He told me about nocturnes or night scenes and how he'd use his audio diary to help him.
Initially coming out here, we had quite bright moonlight, and it was somewhat eerie, the staggered lines of Marines, two rows, each Marine kicking up a small path of dust. And then the Marines, the further you look down the trail, were fading into sort of a slight cloud of dust. Here and there, a bottle of discarded water catching the moonlight. The sound of squeaking gear, occasional coughing. You can hear the crows starting to call. Dogs barking. It's still dark. You can hear the tanks are rumbling closer. All you can see is the dust, the smoke. You can't really see the tanks other than two little tiny, slightly orange lights, those NVG headlights. Now they're kind of coming up over the berm. The light from the city's hitting them, and you can make out their form. The first tank, I would say, is probably about 40 feet away from me, coming up on the berm. And to a halt.
That recording was part of what Michael used for his watercolor Hump Up to New Ubaidi by Moonlight. And you can see that image on our website at thestory.org. Michael makes a connection between what he saw there in Iraq and the work of another American war artist, Frederick Remington. Remington painted scenes from the Spanish-American War a little over 100 years ago.
There was a show at the National Gallery called The Color of Night, and it was focused exclusively on Remington's nocturnes. And the thing that blew me away when I was looking at the website for The Color of Night was the little introduction said that there was such a change in Remington's art before he went to the Spanish-American War and when he came back, because he had never done nocturnes before. And so the nocturnes were sort of, he was dealing with his, you know, sort of shadow material. And so I would say that probably, I hope that some of that, these experiences, which, you know, that I've had, that could be considered somewhat on the dark side of life, shadow material, that it finds a way to express itself in something that, you know, you asked about the word beauty, you know, something that turns out to be beautiful or significant or, you know, resonates with people. And hopefully, you know, 100 years from now, 200 years from now, whatever, if somebody ever writes about me, you know, it's there in the art. There's whether it's the brush stroke, the looseness, the tightness, the color choices, you know, I think I'll probably leave that to somebody else to analyze.
You can see photos of Michael Fay in the field and a number of his pieces in a gallery of images we have on our website. That's all at thestory.org. Warrant Officer Michael Fay is one of two artists hired to paint in the field by the Marines. Now, when I'm back in just a moment, we'll lighten things up a bit with your brushes with fame, stories you've contacted me about in those instances when you find yourself up close and personal with someone you admire. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Our brushes with celebrity are never what we expect them to be. I guess that's why they make such great stories. And let's face it, sometimes we stretch the facts to suit the circumstances. For example, and this is true, it happens that the actor Ted Danson went to the same high school in Connecticut as me. Now, we weren't there at the same time. I've never met him, but back when I was acting in college, I could still say and did, "Oh, Ted Danson, we went to the same high school." It wasn't a lie. Well, Laurel Benedict is one up on me. She went to the same middle school as Ted Danson, but she was there at the same time. It wasn't, though, a great year for Laurel.
By eighth grade, I was 5'7" and 145 pounds, and I was totally full-grown woman, and I felt like an Amazon, because all the guys
were 5'3".
And
their voices hadn't changed.
And they were so funny. And the guy I really liked was 5 foot high, you know. So.
I won't say where he came up to. Poor guy.
Well, he probably liked that, you know.
So was there anyone else in the class who caught your eye?
Yeah, there was anybody who had a great sense of humor I was pretty much in love with. But, you know, physically, there just wasn't a guy that was up to my level, so to speak, until this Adonis walked into the school named Ted Danson. Tall, thin, good-looking, and tall.
Tall, thin, and tall.
Well, at least as tall as I was, and maybe even bigger, I don't even know, but right off he caught my eye.
And so did you guys hit it off?
Oh, are you kidding? No way. It was one of those secret admiration things that girls have.
A crush.
You know, I suppose boys, yeah, a crush. Flagstaff, Arizona was a wonderfully unique place to grow up. I lived on Mars Hill where the Lowell Observatory was, and my father had worked at one time for the Museum of Northern Arizona, and Ted's dad was the director of that museum. So I was well aware of who his dad was and what his status was.
So could you engineer chance encounters? I mean, did you hang out at the museum on Saturday afternoon?
I tried that. I hung out by the dinosaur and rode my bike out on the road with my girlfriends in great anticipation of running into him. Needless to say, he didn't hang around the museum, duh.
But, well, where was he?
Here was where I arranged to see him and be in the same atmosphere. Every day after middle school, when the last bell rang, my girlfriends and I would head down to the bakery on Main Street, Flagstaff. And we'd walk in, and there would be the donuts in the case, and we'd pick out a donut and a Coke and sit down and wait. And sure enough, Ted and his buddies would show up and do the same thing. And they'd sit in opposite booths, and we'd sit across the bakery and look at them and try to figure out how we were going to break in a conversation or whatever. And one day it happened. My friend Sharon somehow flirted with one of his buddies, and we got over to the same booth for them. Doggone, it was just the biggest day, you know.
It's getting warm in here, you know.
And then my friend Sharon got to sit next to him, and I was down the way, and I was at a loss for words. You know how that is when you're really crazy about somebody and you can't say anything intelligent? And that was my problem.
Did he speak to you there?
I think they might have said hello, a polite hello, and I don't even remember what they talked about.
How long did you sit there?
Oh, maybe 10 minutes. If I'd only known what a great sense of humor he had, I probably would have had a blast with him, but who knew?
You're still thinking about it. You're still, you know, you're still thinking
I'm
about
there.
What would have happened if I'd said.
I'm there still. Well, you know, I didn't care so much once we got out of there. And it was, you know, I was pretty successful in the realm of love, you know, later. But it was just that first kind of crush on a guy. And it was Ted Danson. And of course, you got to remember, I didn't know who he, you know, who knew that 20 years later he'd be on TV. I mean, who cared if it was Ted Danson? Nobody cared. He was a kid.
So did you go all the way through eighth grade without ever screwing up the courage to say, "Hi, Ted, I'm Laurel"?
I absolutely did go through the eighth grade without being able to really make a honest human contact with him, yes. But it was the eighth grade graduation dance that was the ultimate experience.
I'm hearing harps in the background here. Or maybe rock and roll. I don't know. What happened at the dance?
Well, at the eighth grade graduation, we all went through the ceremony. And at the end of the ceremony, we were all to go over to the Episcopal Church in the basement. And the parents had organized this wonderful graduation party in which they laid out food and punch, and they had a record player. Remember a record player? And they had various kinds of dance music going, and they were going to organize us to dance. So I was a great jokester, so we were probably just carrying on like crazy. And
let me just interrupt for a minute here, Laurel. Yeah. Now, kids today in eighth grade will have 3 or 4 dances throughout the year. Is this the first time the eighth grade at your school had got together for a dance?
No, I'm sure we'd had other dances, but I don't remember Mr. Danson being there. I was usually on the wall, you know, the wallflower at those dances. And if you didn't want to be a wallflower, you pretty much had to be aggressive and go out and get the guy, you know.
And you weren't? Was all grown up like you were?
No, I was pretty self-conscious, and I wasn't a cheerleader type. You know, the cheerleader types were cute and bouncy, and, you know, I was tall and...
Far too grown up for these kids.
Yes, I was just superior, wasn't I?
What was the music they were playing at the dance? Do you remember?
Okay, so they were playing square dances and round dances. And so they organized this dance, and it was a circle dance where you advance to the next partner. So by the time you're through, everyone in the dance got to dance with everyone, you know. So I was thinking, well, glory hallelujah, this is my chance.
Dancing studs.
Oh, my gosh, it's fixed. I can do it, you know. So I jumped right in that line, and the inside line, I can even remember this. The inside line were the boys, and we had to, you know, the parents had to drag them in. They were not real keen on dancing, you know. So they dragged them into the middle of the circle, and they formed, and the girls all got around the outside, and immediately there was this running toward the boy you liked the best, except that Ted was taken, you know, so there was no way. So I was with somebody I don't even remember who it was, but all I didn't care because I knew I was going to advance up toward Ted eventually. So they put on the music, and the music's going. And at the end of a phrase, you would step to the side, and the two circles would advance. And I was three boys away, and I was just so excited I could hardly stand.
Your heart's beating.
I was going to be right there in front of him, and doggone it, we were going to dance. And it finally happened, and they came together, and boom, he and I are facing each other. And he looks at me, and he says, I'm not going to dance with you. And he stepped out of line and went over in the corner, and I stepped out thinking, oh, my gosh, that was just like, you know, it was crushing.
That's really awful.
That was just really awful. And so I couldn't even keep it together. I was so shocked. And hurt. So I went in the girls' bathroom and fell apart. I just went in there and cried.
Laurel, it's just a circle dance. Why would he say something like that?
Well, I went in there and I thought a lot about it. I thought, now why would he do that? And I thought, well, for Pete's sakes, you know, I'm a clown, and I always have been. So I'm thinking, this guy's kind of dignified. He doesn't want to dance with a buffoon. This is what I thought.
Oh, it's just... This is eighth grade.
Yeah, but eighth graders, you know, I still work with them, and I can tell you that they're very social
conscious. No, but this is really traumatic. That's what I'm thinking to myself. You know, I mean, you have had your eye on this guy all year long. It all comes down to this moment at the dance. And, you know, it's not like he dances with you and walks away. He won't even dance with you.
Well, he didn't have to even touch my hand or anything. He just wasn't going to go through it. I haven't got a clue. I'm sure he never thought twice about it or ever thought of it again.
What happened that night? You're in the bathroom. You're all a mess. Did you go back out and dance? What did you do?
Oh, no. I went in and I had all my red eyes, and my girlfriends are in there going, what's wrong? What's wrong? And I'm going, Ted wouldn't dance with me. And they said, we're sorry. And my best friend Sharon said, what do you want to do? And I said, I'm calling my dad. So I called up my dad and I said, Dad, come and get me. He says, what do you mean, come and get you? I said, I'm sick. He says, you're sick? Well, how can you be sick? And finally I'm going, look at Dad, I'm sick, okay? Come and get me.
I hope he did. Did he?
He finally showed up, and I'm standing out there in front of the church, out of the party, my girlfriend Sharon and I, and we get in the car, and he goes, okay, so tell me really what happened. So by the time we get to my house, he gets it out of me. Well, what happened was Ted Danson refused to dance with me, and it hurt my feelings. And he goes, oh, gee, well, you could have just said, you know, Ted, mind your dancing. You know, that was typical of my dad. It was his pun. And I said, you know, that doesn't help.
Yeah.
So I remember we got in the house, and Dad says, well, I'm going to take pictures of you, you know, for your eighth grade. He was always a camera guy. You know?
Did you have a special dress for this? dance
as
well?
Oh, I had a special dress.
Oh, you're killing me.
I had my hair done. And I want to tell you, yesterday I substitute taught for eighth grade, and I told them this story, and they were on the edge of their seats because I think it hit them so, it was so true, everything I was describing about my feelings.
Did you ever see Ted Danson again, the eighth grade Ted Danson?
I never saw him again. They whisked him away to Kent, Connecticut.
Where he went to private school. I know, because I went to that same school.
Isn't that amazing?
And I lived with the legacy of Ted Danson, the actor. He was 2 or 3 years ahead of me. And it was like, oh, Ted Danson was here. Ted Danson did this. Ted Danson says, what did anybody want to get into drama in the Kent school for? I couldn't live up to the reputation that he set.
So, and you know what amazes me? Well, I was just going to say, when you look back, there wasn't a clue that guy was going to be an actor. I mean, there wasn't any sign of personality that I saw personally.
But he was good looking. Laurel Benedict is recalling her close encounter with the actor Ted Danson. You're listening to The Story from American Public Media. I'm Dick Gordon. So I wondered what happened years later. Danson, we know, went on to fame, playing the role of Sam Malone on the TV show Cheers. Laurel had long since forgotten about eighth grade.
Okay, it was so strange. Life goes on, and we forgot about that. 20 years pass. I'm raising my kids. I'm running a business. I'm just entrenched in my life. I never have time to watch television. One night I sit down and I turn on the TV and it's, "Where everybody knows your name." And all of a sudden, there's Ted's face. I'm going, oh, my God.
Did you know it right away? Did you see that grown-up's face and go, oh, my God, it's him again?
It's instant.
Oh, wow.
I just flipped out. I flipped out. I just danced around the room thinking I could hardly stand my skin. So I thought, I got to contact somebody from our past. I wonder if they know he's on TV, I wonder if they know this. So I call up my friend and I say, "You're not going to believe who I saw on television." I said, "Ted Danson from eighth grade." She says, "Oh, for Pete's sakes, Laurel, he's been on for years on Cheers. Where have you been?" So I figured I was kind of out of the loop.
So you know you can go to the video store and buy like seasons of Cheers. I hope you're not doing that. I hope you're not living that eighth grade.
I never watched Cheers. I never could get myself to watch it.
I'm never going to watch it again either. I thought he was a nice guy.
Oh, no, don't do that. Okay, now here's the funny thing. Once I faced him on the TV, I thought, you got to get over this, girl. You can't carry this eighth grade resentment. And this guy's grown up and maybe you ought to find out something about him and get over it. So I started reading articles on him and I was blown away because I got to thinking, doggone it. I think I even wrote in a journal one time. I wrote, there must have been something in the soil and the air and the water that made Ted and I actually have the same values. He valued the Native American cultures, which I always did, and he was a conservationist. And so all of a sudden I went, he's a great guy.
Just because you didn't wind up in his arms at that eighth grade dance doesn't mean that you weren't psychically linked somehow.
Absolutely. And I even kind of hesitate to even tell this story because I don't want people to dislike Ted Danson because actually he's a terrific guy. And a grown-up form. He was a jerk in eighth grade, okay? But he was great. He's a great guy.
Oh, Laurel, that's a great story. I thank you for sharing it with us.
Oh, sure.
Making your way in the world today takes everything you got. Taking a break from all your worries sure could help a lot. Wouldn't you like to get away? Sometimes you want to go where everybody knows your name.
Laurel Benedict with her recollections there of Ted Danson, the Sam Malone character in the television show Cheers. What about your own encounter with fame, fortune celebrity, those brushes that you anticipate with the man or the woman of your dreams that never really turn out the way they're supposed to. We're also interested in hearing your own story, turning points, transformations, moments that stick in your own memory. All you have to do is go to our website. We're at thestory.org. Send me a couple of lines there, and one of us will be in touch with you. We're also interested in reactions to the stories that you hear on The Story. If you have some thoughts about what's going on, just send me a couple of lines. Let me know what you're thinking. You can also just leave me a message on the telephone. 1-888-966-9862 is the number to reach me. 1-888-966-9862. And you can write to me at The Story, 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. The zip code is 27517. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.